Investigative journalist Joshua Prager's new book, The Family Row, An American Story, is a book that affects both sides of the abortion debate and helps us look at the half century of struggle that brought us to where we are today. The book introduces us to the hidden lives behind Roe, beginning with its plaintiff, Norma McCorvey, and the unknown child whose conception occasioned the lawsuit. Dubbed the Roe baby by some in the pro-life movement, that child has remained unnamed and unknown for 50 years. She shares her story and perspective for the first time in Joshua's book. Joshua Prager is a journalist. He has written for Vanity Fair, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. The new book, The Family Row, An American Story, and we welcome Joshua Prager to the roundtable this morning. Josh, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it.
What brought you to the topic, a very large topic?
Well, I have, for many years, written about people with secrets, people connected to history who have secrets. So to give two quick examples, I wrote about an unknown cheating scandal tied to a very famous baseball game, the 1951 pennant-winning game when the Giants beat the Dodgers and Bobby Thompson hit his home run. And these old men confided to me years ago that they had been cheating, and I wrote about that. And then I wrote about how there was only one anonymous winner in the history of the Pulitzer Prizes. Somebody had taken a photograph of an execution in Iran during the Islamic Revolution, and no one knew who it was. And I went and I found this person in Iran, and he told me his story. And I was fascinated in both cases and other cases, too, about how difficult it is to carry something inside and not be able to speak about it. And particularly when it's something tens of millions of people care about, as I say. So similarly, I was reading an article in The New Yorker back in 2010, an article about gay marriage. And it mentioned in passing Norma McCorvey, Jane Roe, because it was speaking about how sometimes a plaintiff is good for a cause and sometimes she isn't. And it mentioned that Jane Roe, who had switched from the pro-choice side to the pro-life side, had not been able to have an abortion, even though she sought one and even though she won her case, because the case took too long. And I said to myself, wow, that means somewhere there is what I guess people I learned online referred to as the Roe baby. And I assumed, correctly it turned out, that that person, he or she, knew who they were, meaning knew who they had been born to. And I also imagined that that, too, would have been a very difficult thing to carry. So I set off then to look for her. And that's what got me going.
So ultimately, you found her. Shelley Thornton is her name. How did you find her?
I found her after a few false starts. I reached out. Norma did not wish to speak to me. Jane Roe did not wish to speak to me unless I paid her. I explained I wasn't allowed to do that. And I reached out to Norma's former partner, a woman named Connie Gonzalez. Norma had been forced, when she became a born-again Christian, she'd been forced to renounce her homosexuality. And a bunch of years later, she left Connie, her partner, who had stood by her through thick and thin, mostly thin, unfortunately. And when I found Connie, she had had a stroke, and she and her caretaker, her niece, were with me. I went back to visit them, and they told me, I went back a second time, and they told me on that second trip that their house had been foreclosed on, and it was the house Connie had lived in with Norma. And they told me that Norma's papers were in the garage and that they were about to be thrown out. And I said, whoa. Please don't throw them out. I would like those papers. I got the papers. I later acquired them from Norma. And on that first night, as I was going through them, thousands of papers, I found one piece of paper that had the date of birth of the Roe baby. Norma had mentioned the date of birth in an interview she gave to a Catholic newsletter, June 2nd, 1970. And from there, I found Shelley Thornton, and I was off on my adventure.
Give us a sense of the family tree, because Shelley is the youngest of Norma McCorvey's three daughters, correct?
That's right. Norma was gay and slept with hundreds of women. She was very sexually active. She was, she told me, and she had actually, among the other things I discovered learning when I was writing about her, she was even a prostitute for a time, although her clients were men. But she had she gave birth to three children with three different men from 1965 to 1970. She was briefly married at the age of 16, and she had these three children. All three of the children she gave up for adoption. One of them she relinquished to her own mother, the eldest child. She later lied and said that her mother had kidnapped that child from her. Norma lied a lot, and so she was a complicated person to write about. But with the help of those papers and with the help of hundreds of people I tracked down who had come in and out of Norma's life, I was able to sort of get the facts right. And those three daughters had always looked for one another and were desperate to find each other. And in 2013, after I'd found all three of them, they realized that I told them I had done so, and they told me they wanted to meet one another. And so I brought them together, and that was a very moving thing to behold.
I want to talk about that meeting. I just want to, first of all, clarify that Norma McCorvey passed away in 2017. Did that have an impact on you telling the story? I mean, I assume you knew it was coming, but did it have an impact of getting everything together?
That's a good question. You know, there were some things I wish I'd known to ask her before she died, but we'd already spent several years together, hundreds of hours together. And in some ways, it's obviously harder to write about a person who has died. They're not there to confirm or verify or question. But in other ways, it's easier, particularly when you're writing about such a difficult and complicated person. They're not going to challenge you on things that you know are true. And Norma was a very difficult human being. She did not want to be a mother and was unfit to be a mother. And she also alienated almost everyone else in her life, her partners, her friends, the people she worked with on both sides of the issue. And so in some ways that helped me, I think, the fact that she was not there over the last few years of my writing. But I actually wish that she had been alive to see it to the end, because ultimately she was happy that I was writing this book. She helped me do so and wanted the facts told straight, because she had never done that before.
Joshua Prager is our guest. The new book is The Family Row, An American Story. I interviewed Norma McCorvey in 1994 for her book, I Am Roe, My Life, Roe v. Wade, and Freedom of Choice. She made it very clear at that time and in that book and in our conversation about how her position of abortion had changed radically and was pro-life at that point. Talk a little bit about the pressures on her and the varying positions that she took over the years.
Well, you're right. She switched over to the other side, I believe it was the year after that, in 1995. You know, Norma had a lot of pressure on her. You're right. She identified herself as Jane Roe in 1973, a few days after the Roe decision, but she didn't sort of begin to represent the movement, to work for the pro-choice movement, for at least another decade. And it wasn't really until 1989 when she went to a big march on Washington for a march for reproductive rights, where she met Gloria Allred, who then took her to California, the famous lawyer. And that was really when Gloria put her in front of the cameras and did interviews and press, and Norma started to step into the spotlight. Norma knew inside how she felt about abortion. In that first interview a few days after Roe, she said that she believed in abortion through the first trimester. But there was pressure on her to say something different. Roe, of course, made abortion legal through viability through the second trimester. And Norma started to sort of educate herself about those issues. A girlfriend of hers helped her do so, and she started to speak publicly about it. She wasn't really, though, the spokesperson the pro-choice wanted. She wasn't polished. She occasionally lied. She was an unreliable narrator. And they didn't give her a seat at the table. They marginalized her. This upset her a lot. And the pro-life, meanwhile, started to sort of woo her. There was an evangelical minister named Flip Benham in Texas who put what he called a crisis pregnancy center just next to the abortion clinic where Norma was working in the mid-90s and sort of won her over and then famously baptized her in a Texas swimming pool. But what was interesting, just as she had been forced to sort of say what she didn't really believe on the pro-choice side, the same was true on the other side. And in the first interview she gave to Ted Koppel, actually right after her conversion, she said something that infuriated the pro-life, the Operation Rescue folks who had won her over. She said that she believed in abortion through the first trimester. They said, oh, she's a newbie Christian, you can't sort of put stock into what she's saying. And they quickly told her what she needed to say. And she then towed the party line, saying that abortion ought to be illegal from conception on, et cetera, no exceptions for rape, incest, and all that. Well, she still believed what she believed. And late in life, as she stepped away from the pro-life too and sort of pushed all of Roe aside, she spoke increasingly openly about her feelings to her family and to her friends and said, look, I don't think abortion ought to be legal deep into a pregnancy. I don't think one woman should have many abortions, she said, but she definitely believed that abortion ought to be legal through the first trimester. And that mirrors, by the way, what the majority of the American public feels, that if you can not regulate abortion as it's currently regulated through the first trimester, have sort of unrestricted legal abortion through the first trimester, that's what a majority of Americans believe. And so in this respect, Norma represented the American point of view. And in fact, she represented them in other ways too, which made her such a wonderful person to write about and, you know, through whom to sort of tell this larger story, because her life and her family's life was also sort of riven by what seemed to her the incompatibility of sex and religion. And it's that same sort of incompatibility that I think is largely responsible for why America is where it is regarding abortion. So she was a wonderful subject to write about.
Joshua Prager is our guest on the roundtable this morning. His new book, The Family Row, An American Story. When you located all three of Norma McCorvey's children, and they are their half-sisters, and you bring them together, how interested are they in that? I mean, is this something they want, or did you have to talk them into it?
So they were desperately wanting that. I wouldn't have done it otherwise. They had all tried desperately to find one another. They had all been alerted to the fact that they had half-sisters, that their biological mother, and the first one, the eldest one, Melissa, knew who her mother was. The other two did not. Shelley only found out, the youngest, baby Roe, only found out when she was almost 19. The third one, who was the middle child, Jennifer, she found out through my work many years later. But they'd all wanted to know for various reasons, reasons that I think are common among children who are adopted. They all wanted to know if they had any siblings. The first and the third, Melissa and Shelley, had actually briefly found one another many years before, in the early 1990s, but they hadn't come together. Shelley had gotten nervous, and for various reasons, she didn't want to see that child because she felt that seeing Melissa would lead her to Norma. And she and Norma had had a falling out. We could talk about that. But yes, when it was came time for me to do it in 2013, they were eager to do so. Mm. And having them come together was really moving. Their lives were complicated, as so many lives are, and being connected to Norma and Roe is also complicated. But they actually just spontaneously walked outside of the house of Melissa, where they were meeting, and went across the street to a playground. It was interesting. And so here these grown women sort of went back to being children and enjoying the childhood they'd never been able to share together. They went on swings and laughed, and it was a beautiful thing to behold, even though, of course, just being related to each other is not the same as having a family. And some of those complications came into play in the years that followed.
What was the relationship like for the three with their mother? I mean, this happened a few years before her passing.
Yeah, they all had tricky relationships with Norma for different reasons. Melissa struggled because she had had Norma in her life. And Norma, as I say, was a very difficult person and really unfit to be a mom. To give one sad example, when Melissa was a young girl, Norma locked her in a car so that Norma and her then boyfriend, the person who actually was the biological father of the third, so Melissa was 5 years old at this time, so that they could hang out and have a nice evening together. That was not atypical for Norma. And yet Melissa remarkably was there for her mother at the end of Norma's life, taking care of her. The second child, Jennifer, she struggled with what she saw as her inheritance or genetic inheritance from her mother. She was very open with me, Jennifer was, that she had struggled with alcohol and drugs, and she'd overcome those struggles, but she'd always wondered who her biological mother was because she felt that she had sort of genetic predispositions to those problems. And in fact, Norma struggled with the very same thing. And finally, Shelley struggled because she had found out when she was 10 days shy of 19 that she had been born to Norma. A tabloid had approached her in a parking lot and told her that they were going to write about her and unmask her, whether she wanted them to or not. They didn't name her, but they did write about her. And suddenly Shelley then felt, oh God, I now am connected to this very difficult person. She felt an enormous burden, not only having to keep a secret, but she felt that she wanted no part of being a symbol for the pro-life community. And they saw her as a symbol, the sort of incarnation of their argument against abortion. And so they all had these very difficult things that they carried. And Shelley, in particular, had then another reason to be upset at her biological mother when a few years later they spoke on the phone and Norma told her, when they got into a fight, that she needed to thank her. And Shelley said, why? And Norma said, for not aborting you. And setting aside even, of course, that is a horrible thing to say, Norma had actually, of course, wanted to have an abortion. Shelley said she then knew that she would never meet her mother. She couldn't. Although, interestingly enough, she found it within herself years later when Norma was dying to contemplate meeting her. She felt for her mother. She felt bad that this person's life had been defined by abortion. And she wrestled with whether or not to meet her. And ultimately, in the end, she did not.
How much do the three wrestle with the issue of abortion itself?
Well, all three are sort of, they resist the sort of absolutes of either side. All three say that they believe that a woman ought to have the right to an abortion. And yet, though they all had sort of complicated pregnancies, meaning complicated circumstances in which they became pregnant, all three decided that they would not have abortions. And all three feel that abortion should be legal only through the first trimester of pregnancy. They do believe that it should be available to a woman if she's been raped, for example, so they believe in exceptions, but also they feel that it should never be used, and I'm using their words, as a method of birth control. So they all do believe in a woman's right to choose, and yet are sort of uncomfortable with what they see as that right being extended by law a bit too far.
As this book comes out, of course, there are major questions still, the Texas abortion law and the DOJ looking to take Texas to court over this, and seemingly that abortion is illegal in the state of Texas. And obviously there's another case pending before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court's inaction in the Texas case question brings up questions as to how they will rule in the future. So with all of that, you are writing this story, and yet it I'm wondering what impact that has, especially now as this all comes out, because it does put many names and many faces to a not only a controversial but a very complex issue.
Yeah, you know, if there's one thing that my book tried, that I tried to do in my book, it was to humanize the issue. There is a lot of rhetoric and a lot of propaganda, to be perfectly honest, on both sides. I myself am pro-choice. I mentioned that in my author's note, but I did not write this book as an activist. I wrote it as a journalist, and I wanted people to understand that abortion is fraught for good reason, for very good reason. And I humanized the issue. I wrote about the people who sort of helped this country get where it is, not only Norma and her children, but others, an abortion provider named Curtis Boyd, who's very important in the pro-choice community. Mildred Jefferson, who was the first black woman to graduate Harvard Medical School and became one of the architects of the pro-life movement. And finally, Linda Coffey, the lawyer who filed Roe and really first articulated its legal reasoning. These people also, their stories also resist the sort of, you know, pat categories that we have on both sides. So I wanted people to understand that it's complicated and that if you really understand how people come to where they are, you understand why this is a difficult issue. I do think that both sides will sort of look through my book for ammunition that they can then use to hit the other side over the head with. And there is ammunition there, but it is a very fair-minded book. And you know, the timing is a little crazy that after a decade of working on it, suddenly Roe is going to be sort of on the table in the upcoming term. But I'm happy that sort of just in time, people, while it's still legal, people can look back and read and learn about how we got here and maybe have more informed opinions about it.
How interested is Shelley talking about the story as this book comes out? I know Melissa has done interviews. What about Shelley?
It's a good question. I can't speak for her in that regard. I know that she had decided she was ready to step forward in the pages of my book. I think it's probably a very complicated thing to suddenly be out in the public, have your name known. And I think that I know that she is going to be speaking publicly. She's let me know that. And, you know, one thing that she's very clear with is she wants it known that she's not a symbol and that she is someone apart and distinct from Norma and Roe. And I think if she has a message, it will be sort of that first and foremost, and that she will not wish to speak too much about Roe itself and its future in this country.
Meanwhile, Melissa Mills, who was Norma's oldest daughter, has given interviews and spoke to you for the book as well. And as you said before, I mean, she had spent time with her mother. So there's more context there, isn't there?
Exactly. She's the only one of the three who really knew her mother, their biological mother. Absolutely. And so she has a little more to say on it. You know, she, as I mentioned earlier, she sort of found it within herself to take care of her mother at the end of Norma's life, which is really a remarkable thing, given everything that Norma did to her and didn't do for her. In some ways, the motivating principle of her life was to be someone different than Norma. And in choosing to take care of Norma and in choosing to be a mother to her children, she has done exactly that.
Joshua Prager is the author of the new book, The Family Roe, An American Story. It is published by Norton. Josh, I thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Family Roe, An American Story by Joshua Prager. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.